With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture in film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and Carolyn Morissette. Carolyn is a film programmer and development coordinator for the Blood in the Snow Film Festival and a contributing author to works including the first edition of the Women in Horror Annual. Visit our website, viewfromthedark.ca, and you can listen to our podcast, Really Melanated. As you might expect, Carolyn's knowledge base is encyclopedic, so we're glad to welcome her to the show. I remember seeing 1986's Jumping Jack Flash for the first time when I was 9, and being struck that not only was I watching a woman, Whoopi Goldberg, leading a spy movie where I'd only ever seen women as the sidekick or the side piece, she was funny and quick and brilliant and gorgeous and, let's face it, had an amazing sneaker game. I still want a pair of those bright yellow Reeboks. It was revelatory for me to see a woman in that kind of role, and just as revelatory to discover that a woman, Penny Marshall, also directed the film. We can debate whether the film holds up or not. What matters is what it meant for me to see and know that women could do these things on that scale. So I can only imagine what it was like for people in 1974 and 1975 to walk by newsstands and see Beverly Johnson, the first African-American supermodel, on the cover of a major fashion magazine. Carolyn, you're a fashion person. Let's talk about Beverly Johnson.
Yeah, absolutely. She was, as you were saying, the first African-American supermodel on the cover of Vogue, I believe in 1974. And I was a makeup artist for like 15 years.
Oh, okay, yeah. You know what you're talking about.
So finding somebody that looked like me in fashion, it was a big deal. So yeah, and she's like an advocate for like equal rights within the fashion industry. I know she basically helmed like trying to get Black and people of color within the behind the scenes of fashion as well as in front of the camera.
Didn't she come up with like a name, like a rule with her name in it or something like that?
Yeah, it's actually, yeah, the Beverly Johnson rule. Okay. So it's the solution to lack of diversity in the fashion industry. So she wants at least 2 Black professionals to be interviewed for executive positions because there's not enough representation. So, and she also talked about bringing your own makeup artists and hairstylists to the shoots because a lot of Black models didn't have people who knew how to do hair and makeup. But, you know, so I think that's pretty important.
I think what I found kind of fascinating about her as I started to read more and more interviews, she was very highly interviewed, especially recently. She was called on a lot to talk about Black Lives Matter issues, as well as she was one of the Cosby accusers and an early Cosby accuser, like 2013 mm-hmm. is when she came out with her accusations. Her memoir almost didn't get published because she had an accusation in it and the publishers thought it was a liability and didn't want to publish it. But she talks about how early in her career, she thought this was very much a civil rights thing. They were breaking down barriers. Finally, Black people had arrived in the 70s, and she was an icon of that. And then very quickly, she realized, oh, no, no, I am a token. That's unfortunately what I am. But I am in here, and I'm going to do my best to make things better for people. So, like, she would push, as you said, to have Black makeup artists, Black hairstylists, Black executives, Black editors. But her stories of some of the racism she encountered, apparently in one film shoot in New York, she was in a pool with a bunch of other supermodels, and the editor came out and demanded that the pool be drained and everybody get out. And she was later told it was because she was in it, and that the hotel had gotten upset because there was a Black woman in the pool. Which is just like, Jesus Christ.
That's Dorothy Dandridge stuff right
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
So, like, what is happening?
But like 40 years later.
Yeah. But I mean, this woman was like this. She's not dead. She's still this incredible high achiever, right? But like, she was a competitive swimmer at a very high level. She was training to be a lawyer before she became a model. Like, she's just working at this high level. And she was one of the first models to have her own like hair and, like, did she have a skincare line too? I know she definitely
has a hair extension in the handbag line.
Yeah, she has a skincare line. She sells her wig company has been in business for a very long time. And she actually took it over. I think she was in a partnership with a Korean hair company.
Interesting.
And then she decided, you know what? I want to make sure that this is like a Black owned business.
Good for her.
So she took it over herself. So, and it's one of the top selling wig lines, which I probably will be looking up shortly because my hair is out of control.
It's COVID. Our hairs are all out of control, my love. Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear you. It's just, it's when you see these people who are achieving at this level and then you hear the extra stuff they had to go through in order to achieve something that, like, to be a supermodel, to be on the cover of Vogue, that is like the Oscars for that particular career. But the fact that she did all that other stuff and was dealing with all this other stuff in addition to that to get to that point, to be the first, and even though that's a token at the time, that is still groundbreaking, is like, man, what an incredible human being.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And she's still going. And I think her daughter is a plus size model.
She is.
And it's like she just will not stop. And I love it. So
no, I'm totally there with you. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about Beverly Johnson is people who like had these unconventional career paths up into greatness. And the director of our first film today actually had the similar thing. A lot of people don't know that Berry Gordy was actually a prize fighter. And so that's kind of what he did initially. And then he joined the military and then he became a songwriter. And then Motown happened. You know, it was that easy. It was that easy. But he, of course, directed our first film. It's the only movie he directed. He produced a bunch more, but it's the only one he directed. There's probably a reason for that. We'll talk about that. But first, the star of our first film, it's unfortunate she didn't do that many of them. I mean, you can talk about her Oscar nomination, her BAFTA nomination, as well as her multiple nominations and wins for the Golden Globes. You can also talk about the fact that she fronted one of the greatest girl groups of all time and was an astronomically successful solo artist. In fact, she holds the Guinness World Record for most hit singles by a female artist, and that's 70. And in our disco episode in season one, we discussed the influence she had with both Motown and in Hollywood, getting the whiz from stage to screen. Of course, we're talking about Diana Ross. And one of my favorite weird trivia tidbits is that she was involved in the most incredible early 80s love triangles that I genuinely strive to imagine, even though I have seen the pictures, and there are pictures, that involved Cher and Gene Simmons of Kiss. Just take a second to think about that.
I don't know. I mean, it's great visually, but I don't know that it's anything else otherwise.
Yeah. But I, in my head, it's something more. I get it. Now, appropriately, a bizarre love triangle is at the center of our first movie today, and it involves Diana Ross paired once again with her Lady Sings the Blues co-star, Billy Dee Williams, which makes sense because together those two are just so electric. But then let's add into that mix Norman Bates himself, Anthony Perkins, as a sleazy fashion photographer. But, you know, don't stop there. Toss in an eccentric European count slash businessman, fashion show histrionics, frolicking fountain photo shoots, and a Cinderella story that has an ending that just begs for a recut. Ebert said, Mahogany is a big, lush, messy soap opera, so ambivalent about its heroine that we can't even be sure the ending's supposed to be happy. And yet, it's unabashedly commercial and sure to be an enormous hit. This is a hit with me. I love this movie so much. Carolyn, I know you love Mahogany like I love Mahogany. Do you want to give us a quick plot summary?
All right. So Mahogany is all about Tracy Chambers. She's a designer who works as a secretary at a department store in Chicago. So her designs are over the top, and she's got a style that can't be stopped, even though her design school teacher is telling her to calm down. But she wants to fulfill her dreams in the fashion world. At work, she meets a big time photographer called Sean McAvoy, played by Anthony Perkins, the one and only. And
to like creepy excess, exactly. Like he's so perfect for this.
Yeah. And like he sees her, he thinks she's a model, but her boss completely, you know, quashes that and says, no, she's just my secretary. Sean sees something in Tracy. Mm-hmm. And Tracy also lives in the south side of Chicago, where Brian Walker, a local politician and activist, he's working against gentrification of that neighborhood. And their paths cross when she plays a bizarre trick on him or a prank.
Yeah, yeah.
And lands him in jail. Tracy feels bad, bails him out, and the sparks fly. So Brian basically doesn't support her career as a fashion designer. When Tracy gets a call from Sean to encourage her to come to Italy, she takes it. And she is met with the photographer's controlling hand. He renames her Mahogany. Bizarrely.
Yeah, because, you know, inanimate object, yeah. Right? Like, you gotta rename her. She can't be Tracy.
Nope. And her career as a model takes off. But when Tracy rejects Sean romantically and he sees her trying to push her designs, their relationship hits the rocks. And after an insane photo shoot accident where Sean dies, Tracy recovers with the help of a rich European businessman named Christian. So from there, she restarts her career, but then she has to make the ultimate decision between fashion and love. So.
She also turns into a tyrannical monster at the end because apparently she cannot handle being a designer, which is very weird. It's weird. The montage at the end makes no sense considering what we know about Tracy throughout the entire film.
Completely. Mm. Yeah. you saying that being her becoming a tyrant, like, it just really kind of dismisses women trying to be a boss, you know, being a boss lady, and like, women who are in charge have to be horrible. And they make her choose her between her dreams, and then there's these three men trying to control her, and it's like, just let her be.
She's obviously got that it factor. Just let her be it. It's
let
very
her
strange.
Be. Yes. And
there's the weird tension that I think a lot of, especially like Black feminists point to too, where it's like, she can have her fashion line in Europe, but nobody ever suggests, like, Billie Dee Williams is like, come back to Chicago, but never says come back to Chicago and have your fashion line in Chicago. That never even comes up, even though that's like the seat of Black business in the 1970s.
Exactly. It's like, you don't think that Black women would want to wear Tracy's designs and support her? Like, hello.
And you know, she has like, she's got the fun seamstresses she works with. Like, all she needs is that money.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and I think that's what I find so fascinating about this film. And I think there is the seed of a really good movie if you didn't put all this bonkersness on top of it. Because what it really comes down to is it's this idea of having someone played by, like, the Brian character, who is socially conscious and thinking about what people need. And then you have someone who is very ambitious and business driven and wants to work in an industry that is not socially conscious and work and maneuver within it. And I think having those two parallels is really interesting, because the points that Brian makes about the fashion industry are incredibly salient. You have that moment where she's helping Sean plan out this photo shoot and the projects, and you've got all of these white models in like furs and whatnot on all of these derelict buildings, and she's pulling in interesting faces, quote unquote, from the neighborhood. And Brian brings up the point of, look, do not bring these people in, because they're not getting paid what these models are getting paid, and therefore you're exploiting them. Like, that's not good.
How much are these models making?
$60 an hour, 70.
How much are you going to give the old lady?
I don't know, but that's not the point. This is fashion stuff, not politics.
Everything's politics, honey.
Maybe to you, Brian, but not to me. This is my worry you're looking at now.
With a little colorful mind thrown in for effect, huh?
He's not wrong. So if you actually kind of dug into that more rather than making it this weird frothy soapy thing, I think you actually have a really fascinating film.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. This is fascinating in its own way. Yeah. In that you're like scratching your head at the end. Yeah. Because I think it's like you say, it's kind of like three quarters. You're like, all right. And then just right at the end, you're like, what the hell?
What just happened?
Partially because they set up Tracy to be, like, she's bold enough that she doesn't even break up with Billie Dee Williams. She just goes to Europe. She just is, like, kind of spurned, kind of annoyed, and gets the opportunity to go to Europe and kind of tries to send him a message, but mostly just takes a taxi straight to Europe. It's shocking he is as polite as he is when he comes to Europe. Yeah.
But he also just keeps showing up and being toxic. Like, the two of them are the only reason I think you want them to end up together is, well, and I don't, but, you know, that you would want to, is because those two have such insane chemistry.
They both act like maniacs. Like, when he's in Rome, he acts like obviously he's threatened by a gun at one point. It's fair to say he acts rationally around Anthony Perkins. I think he even doesn't knock his ass out as much as he should.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you trying to do? Kill me? Bye bye, Ella.
Very turned off by just like, you know, trans people being around him or whatever in Rome in a way that's like, hey, aren't you the cool rockin' guy? We thought you were the good one.
I also feel like that's because Berry Gordy, of course, directed this, and he does have a turbulent, shall we say, relationship with Diana Ross, and people have pointed to parallels between the Brian and Tracy relationship, especially the dynamic between the two of them, where maybe if you were in that relationship, you're like, no, we just push each other's buttons, but it's all in good fun. But from an outsider, you're like, no, this is toxic. Like, both actually pretty nasty to each other, and maybe you should not be together. Maybe one of you should be on the other side of the country.
It's also the problem that sometimes happens in romance movies, where this movie mostly has the drama and does not have, like, you just have to fill in your mind, like, I bet there's a bunch of scenes between these scenes where they're enjoying each other's company.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. I mean, like, the table hockey doesn't quite cut it for me. And, you know, speaking of toxicity, when she calls him a loser, like, that to me is just like the last nail in that coffin when you call your partner a loser. How can you do that, you know?
You come limping over here saying, Tracy, I love you. I need you. Sure you need me. You want to know why? Because I'm a winner. I'm a winner, baby. These people love me. And you can't stand it. Because nobody loves you.
Oh, I thought somebody did.
Well, nobody does. And you want to know why? You want to know why? Because you a loser. You're a loser!
Well, and then comparing it to myself of I'm a winner, and it's like, I mean, it's supposed to be that the success has gone to her head because she cannot handle it. But you're like, really? But I think there's a reason why RuPaul has claimed that as one of her biggest catchphrases of like, you're a winner, baby, is because it's just so salient. And how often do you get to see Black people actually say that on film?
Yeah.
Right? And she's right. She's on top of the freaking world at that point.
It's true.
I also think that there's like, there's kind of a weird, when you hear either Billy Zee Williams or Diana Ross, who are the two people I've read interviews with about this film, I think there's a difference between what they were thinking internally and what how the movie ended up too, because like Billy Zee Williams, quite often people always say like, oh, you're like a real Jesse Jackson type character, and he's like, no, Jesse Jackson is good at his job, and this guy's kind of he's an aspiring Jesse Jackson who's kind of a loser. So it's interesting that Billy Zee Williams felt that he was playing him. Because I think he comes off as kind of like, he's a cool, really big achiever. But I think in all interviews, he's quick to point out that this guy's kind of a hothead and probably won't do well in politics because he's not good at politicking, even within his own relationship.
Now, Cam, I know you've done a bunch of research into Chicago at the time, because Chicago around this area is pretty virulent, but it's also a big hotbed for like the Rainbow Coalition and things like that. What was going on?
Yeah, I mean, Chicago always in the 20th century is essentially a very fascinating place because it has these massive waves of Black migration, the Great Migration, including basically industrialization of the South. People needed places to go. Chicago is often where there were jobs. So there was these really big waves, the titular Great Migration, when especially a lot of people were often World War One, and there was a lot of industrial jobs available in Chicago, and there was like pretty significant Black population there already. That happened again in World War Two. Of course, the people were booted out of their jobs.
Of course,
the minute that white people came back. But yeah, so it becomes this tension because there is, you know, the like at the time in the 70s, the South Side was called like the capital of Black America. There was lots of cultural stuff going on, like you say, the Rainbow Coalition. Jesse Jackson was out of there. Like a lot of organizing was out of there. Obviously, a lot of the Black Panthers began in and around there. But the weird tension is, at the same time, from 1955 to 1976, you had Richard Daley as mayor, who was, like, we all kind of nod because we're like, this mayor was so famously racist in Canada. We know his name, which is kind of wild. So the thing to like, that created the tension a lot was that Chicago had some of the, like, strictest, I mean, at least in the North, strictest housing policies, strictest redlining. So, like, these neighborhoods were Black neighborhoods, these neighborhoods were white neighborhoods. And there's fascinating what we'll get into, places like Cabrini Green, which are actually in the middle of other neighbor, like, it's not that they pushed everyone to say, like, Toronto, where we live, where they pushed everyone north. They left parts in the middle of the city where, yeah, so it was like this kind of strange tension where there was significant Black culture and there was all these organizing, but it actually took till about, I mean, obviously, it took till after Richard Daley, and then it took still about a decade to dismantle a lot of the Richard Daley machine, which had really affected Black Chicagoans. So in 1983 is the first Black mayor of Chicago.
Really? That long? But,
yeah.
With that big
a
Black population? So, wow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that there is just, I mean, it's fascinating. You can dig into a lot of the racism and a lot of the very exhausting things. There's stuff like Richard Daley met with Martin Luther King, because Martin Luther King marched on Chicago. Yeah. Like, this is the level of Chicago. And Richard Daley met with him, and they signed an agreement about public housing, which he then promptly ignored and never did anything with, which is like, wow, that is that's some wild stuff. Not a lot of people pulled a fast one on Martin Luther King. It is this fascinating place, and you can see why a lot of these films, especially the films that we're talking about, like the films that are outside of Blaxploitation, that are kind of just looking at Black life, why you would choose Chicago.
Absolutely. It shows that there's so much going on behind the scenes. And, you know, I tip my hat to Berry Gordy because he's talking about Black people as people, Black love, people looking for careers. They want to improve their neighborhood. They want to improve their lives. It's not about, you know, crime and having 18 kids, like, which is a stereotype. And so I think those points are really important, Cam. Yeah.
Yeah, and no one in here is a drug dealer. Like, that's the other
big
thing too, right?
Exactly.
And I think you're showing the social issues still. He's not ignoring that at all, but he's showing it in a way that would affect, you know, a ground level average person.
Yeah,
which is
absolutely
interesting. Yeah. And showing, like, you know, Mahogany is kind of trying to be above it, but finding that they affect her regardless. You know, even if you're an artist operating in this specific world, she is still running into the same stuff that Brian is, and sometimes worse. I mean, I think that they show a fascinating side of racism in Europe too, because she is treated so weird. It's a real
a real thing, because I mean, I spent a summer there when I was 21 and I went to Paris, and there's this, it's a real fetishization of people of color.
Signora McAvoy, Signorina Mahogany, buongiorno, welcome to the Gavina Agency, molto bella. I was telling Signor Mac.
Come on, Giuseppe, let's cut that crap and get this over with.
John, it's okay. I'm in no big hurry.
I'm sorry, Tracy, but this whole routine just bugs the hell out of me.
Write this way, Signor Dean.
John, what about you?
I'll meet you later. I might say something to upset those. Good luck.
I mean, I know there's a big Black exodus to Paris, I think, in the 40s. I think post-war, I believe, and actually even before then, obviously, with the Black Renaissance, because I guess it was such a novelty that they were like, yes, come to our shores. You are a novelty. But that still kind of stays there, even though, like, you know, I remember taking the subway and there were like posters of the National Front. And I remember it says, the National Front is watching you.
Jesus
and it's
Christ.
Like, and it was in a lot of like the banlieue, like the suburbs of Paris. And that's where all the immigrants live. It's this weird, like, you know, we love you, but we hate you kind of
thing. There's a weird fetishization of Asian people as well, because her first fashion collection that Tracy designs is kabuki inspired, and all of the women are wearing kabuki style makeup, and none of them are Asian. They are all white, with the I think there's like maybe one African-American model aside from Tracy in there, but it's like, okay, now you're fetishizing another culture and country. This is very strange.
I think it's very interesting, and you see it in film too, because like Melvin Van Peebles and Gordon Parks, to like make the career, to make the movies that they made in the early 70s, they had to go to France for a while. But I think people find the same thing that Tracy finds, where it's like, there is a fascination, and they want you to tell your story, but they kind of want you to tell your story once and the way that they want you to tell it.
And then
you're either of no use to them or, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
See, again, I feel like there is such an incredible, like, Oscar award-winning film within the concept of this. And, of course, Lady Sings the Blues was unbelievable. If people have not seen that movie, go watch it. It's really something special. And I think the problem is because Berry Gordy is not a good director. So the tone just gets away from him 100%. And he lets Diana Ross, who I am going to make a comparison many people will not agree, is a bit like Nicolas Cage, where she needs to be reined in at certain points, as we see. You know, there's perhaps a performance needs to be cultivated in a certain way.
But I would also say if you reined her in, you would never get. I mean, the part that's crazy is like, I'm fascinated. There's the crazy part where Anthony Perkins is the photographer,
yes,
and he's trying to punish her by essentially killing her in a car accident.
It's amazing.
But he's also like, let me take photos of you that you're terrified. And those photos are great. And the poses she does are great. Like, he's not wrong.
No, I agree. But I've seen people compare this film to Mommy Dearest, in that if you were trying to make a film this wacko and out there and huge, you couldn't do it. It would just end up being silly. But because they really thought, as you mentioned, Cam, they didn't actually know what they were making, it becomes this really special camp thing that is just so imitable and so lovable on a very different level that it was not intended to be, like Mommy Dearest. But also, like Mommy Dearest, it ended a very prominent career in acting. So it's like, you know.
And I mean, I would also say that it's like we say, there's these flaws that seem you could nudge it like a little and you could make this great movie, but also don't try to remake this movie.
No,
like,
don't. Yeah. Take the concept and make
foolish,
something else.
It would be foolish to try to remake this
unless film. You are RuPaul and you are playing both Tracy and Brian, I would watch that.
Didn't they try that with Mariah Carey? Wasn't that Sparkle or something?
Yeah.
Glitter.
Yes.
Glitter? Yeah. Sorry, there we go.
So much so. Okay, which means we have to talk about the theme song now. Do you know where you're going? Because this actually changed the Oscars. So, yeah, do you know where you're going? Originally is not a Diana Ross song, it's a Thelma Houston song, which people should go listen to that version because it is primo. Mariah Carey also covered a version of it, which is as Mariah Carey as you think it is, lots of breathy and then goes into those like whistle tones, of course. The song was not nominated for an Academy Award. Berry Gordy like started to have to campaign for it and he got it in. It did not win. But the problem was is that that's when they changed the rules that the song had to be written for the film and could not have been previously released. So they were like, this now needs to be the thing. You can't just record a cover and have it be the thing. It needs to be a whole new original song.
I will say, as we explore more and more this history of film, the best Oscar song category is a mess.
It really is.
It is. Every year there's some fight.
They're like, it's this. What I also do love is that Mahogany was on the charts for like weeks and weeks. The love theme from Mahogany is what they called it, was on the charts for weeks and weeks and weeks. It was replaced by Love Roller Coaster by the Ohio Players, which I think should be the actual title of Mahogany.
Yes.
But that's okay.
I think I want to hear a medieval version of Mahogany.
Yes.
That's what I want to hear. Like a chamber quartet or something of Mahogany. Just bring it.
It's got to be out there. Yeah. It's got to be.
Are you the new Berry Gordy?
I could very well be. Yeah. Maybe the cat version of it. I don't know.
Meow, meow, meow. Oh, man.
I'm not mad at it.
Of course, the other thing I think people really love about this movie, aside from like the wacko performances and the music, is, of course, the fashion. Because the fashion is absolutely amazing. Andre Leon Talley actually talks about it in his memoir, being like, this is a defining moment in like Black fashion design. And Diana Ross designed the fashions because she didn't like what was coming, which is wild to me.
That's, I guess, another Nick Cage moment.
Yeah.
And she designed the Supremes outfits as well.
What? I didn't
know that.
She
went to design school. And I think she went into modeling initially, but you know, she does have the design background to do it. So, you know, more power to her, I guess.
This woman's got the moves. I'm sorry. The more I learn about Diana Ross, the more I'm like, you are just such an amazing human being, like these incredible achievers. I watched an interview with Tracy Ellis Ross, or sorry, an award acceptance with Tracy Ellis Ross talking about her love of fashion and being in her mom's closet and collecting all of the like debris of glitter and feathers and whatnot, and then fashioning her own outfits out of it. And I'm like, can you imagine just being in a closet full of Bob Mackie originals? Like, I just, as an adult, I'm like, As a fashion-loving teenager, I can't even imagine how that would break your face.
I mean, did they make a like a Barbie doll version of Diana Ross?
They
when
must
you're
have.
That big, right? And then you had you're her daughter and looking at her closet and like, and I love Tracee Ellis Ross. She's so endearing and sweet and gorgeous and she just looks like a fun person. So yeah, I think, yeah, that was a really cute acceptance speech. It was very sweet.
I mean, I want to talk about this Diana Ross Barbie, which is wild. I did not know that existed.
If I'm not mistaken,
no, it's real. It's her, her in
it
a.
What?
I think she's in a Bob Mackie dress.
A Bob Mackie dress. Is it red? Yeah. It's a red sequin dress.
It's a white
right?
one.
It's it's a white. Okay, yeah. Because I remember.
But it
that.
Looks so much like Diana Ross, which is wild.
I can't handle
I'm shocked this is not in every gay man's apartment.
I think I saw there was that. I think Oprah was interviewing Diana Ross and then she brought Billy Dee Williams on to surprise her. Mm. And so they had this lovely reunion. And then she's like, what do you remember most about, you know, acting with Diana Ross? And he goes, her mouth. And I'm like, oh my God. If it was anyone else who said that, they probably would have gotten punched in the face.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Because it was him, I'm like,
oh man. Oh,
that was,
like,
yeah, I mean,
loaded.
Billy Dee is something else.
He's a good thing. He's so pretty. I mean, he's so gorgeous in this film that I can see. I mean, there's so many reasons why I can see why this is also a gay icon movie. I actually watched the movie for the podcast with my buddy who was gay because he'd never seen it. And I was like, well, you know, you're coming in. Let's do this. He was just like, realizing how many cultural touch points there are in a lot of other gay cinema, especially we watched Drag Race together. Like he was like, oh man, this is like 90% of RuPaul's like oeuvre. And he's put it ends up in all of the different scenes and everything. It's definitely a cultural touch point moment, but there's so much homoerotica in here that I do not know if it is intentional. Like that gun battle is so homoerotic and it's just like, ooh, but Billy Dee Williams is also gorgeous. And like, I mean, he is at his like 70s mustache cheekbone best, like it's really something else. Is he considered a gay hunk icon? I know he is not gay, but like, is he considered
a hunk?
Okay,
sure, he's a hunk that acts in plenty of campy.
Okay,
I mean, he's got capes in Star Wars. I'm sure, yeah.
I mean, you can't beat that, right?
No,
it's, you know, it's a gem.
It really is. This is such a gem of a film. And if people haven't seen it, please go watch it. But this is not one to like sit by yourself. I'm having a fine glass of wine, and I'm going to discuss its finer points. Like, get your buddies together over Zoom and watch this one. Like, it is. I hope someone, when theaters come back, I want to actually see this on the big screen with a bunch of other people, you know, dressed up and go. I want to see everybody's Tracy's bests.
Yes.
That's what I want. I also want that rainbow dress so bad. It's so gorgeous in the way it moves. Oh, I love it. I love it.
So gorgeous.
All right. When we come back, we're going to look at a movie that made $13 million on its $750,000 budget in 1975. It's the movie that made Michael Schultz's career, and it's great. That's coming up after the break.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Does the name Mike Evans sound familiar? An accomplished writer and actor, for the purposes of our story, one of the roles he was best known for was Lionel Jefferson. The character of Lionel was a young, outspoken black man who moved down the street from the Bunkers. That's Archie and Edith of All in the Family. those bunkers. That type of character was both unprecedented on television at that time and a huge hit with audiences. And that allowed Mike the leeway to give sitcom super producer Norman Lear a copy of a spec script his buddy Eric Monty had written for All in the Family in order to expand Mike Evans' role on the show. This script would introduce America to Lionel's parents, George and Louise Jefferson. From there, Eric Monty would collaborate with Mike Evans to create Good Times, which was another major hit. Familiar with the catchphrase, Dino Might? Well, that's where that comes from. On the set of Good Times, Eric says he butted heads repeatedly with the white writing staff and Norman Lear, who were insistent on making the characters stereotypical archetypes rather than actual human beings. When Eric got a contract to write his first feature film, he left Good Times and went to work on something that would allow him to create characters and situations that were complex and nuanced and familiar to him as well as many others across America in 1975. But that he hadn't yet seen represented on screen. There's more to the story, which we're going to get into later, but let's start by focusing on Cooley High, which is now an absolute classic. I watched it for the first time for this podcast. I love this now so much. It's now going in my pantheon of like, hey, have you seen this one? Because it's great. And Cam, I know you love this one as much as I do. You're a big Cooley High fan.
Yeah, I mean, I will also say that I came across it working on the show a few years ago. But yeah, when you watch it, you're just like, oh, this is, you know, why is this not canonical, kind of a huge movie?
And just finding out how, like, influentially important it is, like the pouring alcohol on graves that, like, is 90% of hip-hop culture, like, that's from this. Like, there's so many touch points. It's wild.
Yeah, and I think it's also just, like, it's often packaged on DVD and even in the trailers for the film. We're at, like we had said, kind of this tail end of what was considered blaxploitation. But at that point, blaxploitation had mostly been taken over by white writers and directors and kind of driven into the ground by just repeating the same boring stories over and over. So I think that they were still trying to sell it that way. So it sometimes looks a little cheap, sometimes looks a little dumb, but it's a really wonderful film. It's a film that is, like you say, it's about Eric Monty's real life, very heavily inspired by his own high school experience and his experience growing up in Cabrini Green in Chicago. It stars Glenn Turman, who just about everybody probably knows. If you don't, look him up.
You know him.
I mean, most
yes.
recently in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But you know him from being in everything ever since the start of time. Also, Lawrence Hilton Jacobs, who is in Welcome Back, Cotter. A lot of people would recognize him at the time. But yeah, it's so these guys, Preach is the main character played by Glenn Turman. It's him and his friends kind of, you know, they're the usual group of boys getting into trouble, going after girls. And the plot essentially concerns partially Preach going after this fancier girl. And partially it's towards the end of their last year of high school. Preach is trying to get into college. He's kind of the one who has that route ahead of him. And through a series of kind of random circumstances, it's about half a hangout movie. And then it becomes the kind of the rising action is that they get mixed up in an issue with a stolen car. And then a gang is kind of targeting them. And then so what'll they do? What'll Preach do, especially? Preach, who has such high hopes, is suddenly caught between the law and gangsters. But it's really more just about friendship and growing up.
It is one of those movies that when you start watching it, you're like, oh, someone I like is going to die, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's like watching My Girl or something like that. You're like, I am going to leave this better but worse all at the same time.
And I mean, It's based on reality. Yeah. Again, it's the part that seems contrived, but that's the part that Eric Monty says. I mean, it's a friend of his was killed. He says, as an old man, it's quite moving to see him. It really still affects him. And it is what prompted him to leave Chicago and go to Los Angeles.
It's funny because, first of all, this was a first watch for me as well.
Wow.
Like, I had heard about it. And what you're saying, Cam, is true. It's like, it's not really, it should be like canon, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, upon watching it, I'm like, this is really great. And I love the combination of the two films because it's just like people living their lives in Chicago. Yeah. You know, these kids, they have dreams, they have hopes. And like, you know, looking up Eric Monty and seeing the struggles he had, like, I believe he had like an addiction issue. He fell on hard times, and then he kind of clawed his way back up, and he's in rehab, and he apparently has like a laptop full of stories. I think he has like a lot of stories to tell. So
I mean, hearing it. So the big thing with him is that he was never given writer credit or creator credit for the Jeffersons, even though he was not there to create the Jeffersons. He did create the characters. He would also go on to create What's Happening. And he had to fight for creative control and creative rights. He had to sue CBS and Norman Lear and like everybody to be able to get any sort of recognition that he had worked on the creative side of this, of actually creating these worlds and these characters. And unfortunately, what happened was is that the lawyers he had were not great. And he was given a settlement deal of $1 million. And he was like, look, I know this is worth way more than $1 million. And the residuals would kind of float me for life. And the lawyers kept saying, take the million, take the million. And unfortunately, by the time everything came down, the statute of limitations had run out. And so he took the million and unfortunately ended up losing the majority of it, trying to remount a play of his that had done incredibly well earlier and did not do particularly well the second time. So he fell on some hardships there, including his addiction. But like, he created some of the most iconic characters in television.
Totally. And I think it's worth saying too that What's Happening was meant to be a sitcom adaptation of Cooley
High. That's wild.
And you can see how much it was taken away from him, because you can't even really see the DNA of Cooley High in that show. It's barely there.
No, and he didn't know Norman Lear was going to be attached to it when he showed up to work on it. He just was like, it's Norman Lear, and it's one of the producers that he had been working on with, on like the Jeffersons and things like that when it was first being created. And he was like, oh, this guy, crap, which is why he ran. But there's still not great blood between him and Norman Lear, it appears.
Yeah, I mean, that's too bad. And I also, the fascinating thing, I see quite often people credit Cooley High is inspiring The White Shadow, that old show about the basketball coach. It's not really written anywhere, you know? It's kind of like people are just saying that, like, Cooley High inspired so many thinking about Black people in high school and thinking about young Black lives that's kind of the fascinating thing. It's so influential that it becomes almost, people forget to note it. Because it did so much.
Yeah, it's true. Because, you know, as a Black kid growing up in the 70s, like seeing the Jeffersons, seeing even What's Happening, as problematic as it was, I watched that show. We watched Good Times. We watched as many things as we could find that represented us, you know, because I mean, I still watch Dukes of Hazzard and the $6 Million Man and whatever. But unfortunately, I find that when it goes through the machine, these sitcoms basically distill like caricatures and stereotypes. And that's the issue there. Aside from, I would say, the Jeffersons, you know, because George Jefferson is an icon.
Yeah.
You know, I can actually do his dance. Well, when I had a better hip, I could do his dance.
Wow.
But I digress.
But I think, Carolyn, you bringing up, these are just people living their lives. And I think a movie made by somebody else, because this is set in 1964. I don't know if we mentioned that. It's set in 1964. And so this is a film that takes place like smack dab in the middle of when things were really starting to ramp up for the civil rights movements, right? Especially, we mentioned earlier, Chicago was a hotbed of politics. But these are kids. They don't give a heck about that, right? They are just like, we're living our lives. We're going to go to parties with girls. We're going to make out. They get in trouble. One of them dies, which is, you know, again, life, unfortunately, in a reality. But like, you really are watching these kids just have a good time. Like, it's one of my favorite moments is when they're at this like makeout party that they have to pay to go into. And you really get to see not just the boys, because like, you do follow the boys around, but you get a pretty good chunk of what's going on for the girls too. And you get to see their facial expressions, their hopes that like, oh, I hope this guy talks to me. I hope he makes out with me. You see them get totally wooed by like how smooth a couple of them are, and they are smooth. It's like, oh yeah, that would have gotten me when I'm 16, no question. But there's hijinks, but none of it feels tacked on or like 90s bad teen comedy. It feels real. Like, these are what kids would care about, right?
Yeah.
At that party too, like the I forget whose girlfriend's a party was at, but she was so concerned about her mother's cabinet.
Yes.
That is so real. It's like, don't touch my mother's cabinet. Of course, you know, it gets touched to say that.
Yeah. And it's funny that like, it doesn't quite pay off in like a dumb comedy way too. It's like, it's more like just an authentic moment. I think we're like in a 2020 context, to that part of the movie is like Lover's Rock. Like, it's just like it's just like a boat showing a party at the time and how funny it is, and them sneaking in is so funny. Like, they come up with this whole plan of the one guy making out with the door girl so they don't have to spend a dollar to come in. And I
love that it showed that these girls have desires too, that they want to get busy with the guy that they like, you know, because you know, all of these teen movies, I feel like they focus on the men and the boys and trying to get their kind of, you know.
That's why Leslie Harris made Just Another Girl in the IRT, right? Like, it's a complete reversal of this.
Exactly. Like, they want to make out with the guy. Like, you know, I mean, didn't we all want to make out with the cute person that we were? You know, it's a very, it's a normal, healthy thing. So it's really nice to show the aspect of the girls as well, which, you know, it's funny because you wouldn't think, like, I know a lot of like black film often focuses on the black male or black men and they're kind of growing up. And this is centered around like some young black men. But it's nice that there's a balance, you know?
But
there
really is. Despite the dice playing and all that, when they skip school, which I would skip school too if I was having to drone on that list of, like, here's all the things, when a white woman is preaching at me that way.
Yeah, I mean, they do have a pretty light, like, here's a criticism of the school system.
Exactly.
Because it's like a weird white lady being rude about, to black people.
Are you all with me?
Yeah.
We will all read the code together. The Cooley High School Code. Cooley students are conscious of developing good character. We are good sports. We are good losers as well as good winners.
But they skip school and they go to the zoo and hang out with the monkeys. I'm like, that's amazing.
It's like, you know, instead of skipping school and, like, I don't know, doing something kind of, you know, maybe not that great or, like, maybe something, you know, in terms of the crime world or something. But they go to the zoo, like, they're boys. That shows that they're boys.
Breaking into the zoo,
they're just kids.
Yeah,
and I love that.
And I do think you're right that that nuance is very interesting. And the, like, because I think there's a lot of tropes that I'm used to. So, like, they have the whole angle of Cynthia Davis, the main kind of love interest. They have the whole, like, colorism angle where they're like, oh, like, you're never getting with that high yellow bitch. And then, she ends up being a lot more nuanced, too. She does seem like a stuck-up, light-skinned woman, but she is more interesting and nuanced. And then they have kind of a more, they have a more intense relationship than you would figure. And it does bother saying, like, what happened to her and what her deal was. Which, you just don't expect from a movie at all. Yeah, and I do think it's because it's coming from Eric Monte's real life. I think he's probably basing most of these people on real people. He's and he's just filling out everything down to, like, the lady who runs the, you know, snack counter that they're always harassing, and she shows up enough that you love her too. You're like, oh yeah,
with the cleaver.
Yes, the cleaver. No dice, but also it's like still a safe space, even though she kind of hates them. Yeah.
I feel like this is also to the credit of course Mike Schultz, right? Who I think we've talked about in previous episode that really there was only two black directors working in Hollywood at that time. It was him and Sidney Poitier, and that's it. And that Mike Schultz has been around as long as he has because he's so resilient and able to kind of bounce around and do a television. Then he goes back to film, and then he does all these other things. Like, you look at his IMDb, and there's really no consistency in the genre. It's just all, like, 90% good, which is just speaks to the quality of his work. But he co-wrote this with Eric Monte, but did not take the writing credit, which I also appreciate as well. When he got the treatment for it, he was like, this is a story, but it doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end. There's no structure here. There's a lot of great ideas. It's just a series of stuff. So he went with him and tried to help him turn it into an actual, like, screenplay, into a format and a narrative that people would be able to follow. And I think with the two of them together and Mike Schultz's understanding of what cinema was versus television really makes it cohesive and makes it work.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Michael Schultz comes from the Negro Ensemble Company. Like, he's like a theater guy. And I think that they were working with a lot of theater folks. That's, like, also, again, I think the rounded characters is the fact that they came to Chicago and were shooting with a bunch of overqualified black actors who, you know, knew how to do, like, Glenn Turman. He's from Broadway. Mm-hmm. He was in the original Raisin in the Sun. Like, that's wild.
Yeah.
But they also pulled kids off the street, too. Like, didn't Mike Schultz, like, go by in his limo and be like, those two guys playing basketball, I want
them.
I
mean, he apparently asked the police, who was, like, the charming criminals who they liked and chose them. But yeah, it's so I think that it's fascinating. Yeah, Michael Schultz is an interesting guy because he does not have a single writing credit, but you can kind of feel his fingers in a lot of the films he does. And I think especially because quite often, this is not one of the cases, but quite often he is working with white writers about black culture.
Well, Car Wash is his, isn't it? Yeah, and that was with Joel Schumacher. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you name it. He did a lot of, especially the 70s and 80s. I always like that Larry Karaszewski, the big, biographer of film biographer of film people, always says that, everybody talks about, blaxploitation and then Spike Lee. And he's like, there's 15 years in there that's just Michael Schultz, essentially. It's like Crush Groove, Last Dragon, Car Wash. I think Michael Schultz is tweaking a lot of these white writers because a lot of these films become classics to black audiences, and I don't think that would happen if it was just white writers.
No.
Well, it's hugely important because, I mean, you have to have a trust with... I actually just did a little thing on a film about Samoan culture, and, you know, the director was Maori, so he's from that area. He kind of had, he knows the respect. So it's like that respect of the culture and the kind of inner nuances and knowledge that you really need. Yeah. But I mean, can I just mention, though, Glenn Turman was married to Aretha Franklin?
Yes, yes.
And I'm like, what? Because I remember him as on A Different World as the general. He married one of the students there, Jaleesa. But, as you were saying, he's like a theater guy. Mm-hmm. And he met Aretha Franklin. I think her son introduced them backstage. And then she took acting classes from him because he was teaching as well. So... to me, when I saw him, the first time I saw him, wait a minute, that's the general from A Different World. And then I just happened to review the Aretha Franklin biopic and watching the scene where she walks into a class and I'm like, wait, Glenn Turman? Wait. And so I had to look it up and I'm like, what?
Yeah, I mean, it's also, it's fascinating because he's a guy, to me, I guess, the majority of his content I have consumed, he is an older man. So it's fascinating to see him be more or less a teen and see him being very handsome. This movie is a lot about how, as much as he's kind of a dork, it's funny because he's a bit of the nerd, but he's just so handsome and charming that all the women kind of like him.
And he still looks great in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. He still has this, gorgeous face with presence. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even though I think he was in Gremlins.
Yeah, probably.
Anyway, that is not still a bad thing on a resume. Yeah, Gremlins is
exactly. Yeah. But he still has this beautiful, gorgeous face and this presence. And, he's just so, he's such a storied actor. And I just love that he, this was one of his, first films.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons, unfortunately, that a lot of people haven't seen this is that the soundtrack is amazing. It is also almost entirely Motown, and therefore it gets caught up in so many rights things because it's now you got to do sign a separate deal for the music as you do for this. And if you rescored this, it wouldn't be the same. So, because you really, the music sets up 90% of a lot of these period films, right? Yeah. You hear Rock and Robin, you know exactly where you are.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was also an AIP movie. Those rights get handled all over the place. It was when AIP kind of, when Arkoff took over, it kind of was moving away from the, Vincent Price movies and trying to make some real ones. So this one kind of came out around when, Amityville Horror was there. They had a couple big ones before, Chomps, the robot dog movie. It's kind of interesting because it's one of those studios that its rights get moved around. But, We've Got It is coming to Hollywood Suite in November.
Yay!
So, yeah, it's I think, becoming more and more. There's actually a lot of, if you look, there's a lot of great retrospectives now. A lot of great interviews with Michael Schultz and Eric Monty about it. And wonderful interviews with the cast and crew because it was a big deal for Chicago. It really changed the face. And a lot of these people, went on to have interesting careers, or they took the money that they got and did something interesting in Chicago. Obviously it inspired all sorts of people to do various things.
We should probably talk about Jackie Taylor and Rick Stone. We mentioned earlier that Mike Schultz called around to ask who the neighborhood scamps were that the police liked, and they were pointed towards Norman Gibson and Rick Stone. Now, Norman and Rick weren't sure if this was a legit opportunity or someone was pulling their leg, but Rick Stone has said in interviews that they called up Jackie Taylor, who they knew and already had a role in the film as one of the girl group that the boys run with, and she assured them that it was in fact legit, and they were like, well, if it doesn't work out, we're just going to steal stuff from sets, so we'll win either way. It did work out. They're great in the movie, but unfortunately, Norman Gibson was killed in a gang-related incident, I think, just before the film came out, after?
Yeah, right after, right around it.
Yeah, just around the time. And Rick Stone got into a bunch of trouble, ended up in prison. However, he was found by Jackie, who founded a theater company in Chicago, and offered him a job. Said, do you want to come work as a custodial employee here? And, you know, I'll give you some work. And then she found he still really loved acting, and now he's like one of their featured players like all times. He's in all these shows, and he's clearly loving it. It's so great.
Yeah, I mean, it's just important to show that like how much filming can change. Like, this is a woman who had a small-ish part. She's one of the girlfriends, and she took the money and founded this Black Ensemble Theater, which is still going.
Yeah.
And then also this guy, he had a turbulent life, but he's apparently great and gets great reviews for his roles. But there's also stuff like one of the extras was Robert Townsend. And he, like we all know, like from Hollywood Shuffle, Robert Townsend struggled and wanted to drop out of Hollywood plenty and just kind of hated it for decades. But he always says that, like, knowing, seeing that production and knowing that there could be films about regular Black life really inspired him.
Well, and also seeing the actual Cabrini Green on film. And something, Cam, you brought up is that this is actually a really good companion piece to Candyman, because this is Cabrini, weirdly.
Good or bad, but interesting.
Yeah. But because Cabrini Green, this is Cabrini Green at its start, and Candyman is Cabrini Green before it was taken down, before it was destroyed. And that's two really interesting points of view. And I know, Carolyn, you're like a horror movie aficionado. Like, do you see that comparison here? Do you see it?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because, yeah, Candyman, again, you know, I think it wasn't it based on it was based on a Clive Barker short story. And then they kind of incorporated, Bernard Rose was the director, and they incorporated some murders that I think actually happened there.
Yeah, the child murder and coming through the mirror.
Yes.
Both are real
and
murders.
What? Like,
you know,
If you really want to not sleep at night or never get an apartment again, look up, I believe He Came Through the Mirror is the name of the article.
I'm looking this up now, and I will call you later.
It's a nightmare. It's also, I mean, it's also interesting because at the time they're not quite dissecting the racist policing, but there's a real, reading the article really turns your stomach because the white police knock on this woman's door and she doesn't answer, and they're like, well, it's just a crazy projects lady, but she had been stabbed and was laying there dying, and if they had have bothered to get in the door, she probably would have been alive again.
This illustration on the cover of this,
oh yes,
of
the
this
illustration
article
is also particularly nightmarish. It should be the poster for Candyman. Yeah,
I'll save that for later. All right, so Cabrini Green.
Yeah. It's, you know, and I love Candyman. I think it's a beautiful film. I think Tony Todd made, you know, became an icon horror community. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see Nia DaCosta's version, because it's through the eyes of a Black person. Even though they did a really good job, like, there's a lot to unpack in the original Candyman. So, but I'm really curious to see what she's done. And I suspect she's bringing in the gentrification aspect as well. So I really want to see how she approaches that. But it's one of my favorite films, Candyman.
Oh,
so.
Sure. I mean, it's a great horror movie, gorgeous. But it totally misses what this movie gets, which is like what it does not. It uses the residents a bit like a prop.
Exactly.
And I think it overlooks the fact, I don't think it's trying to demonize the people of Cabrini Green, other than the Candyman, I suppose, who is a literal demon. But it's ignoring the fact that essentially governmental neglect and like racist housing policies cause these problems. Like, there's parking lots all over because they didn't want to pay to keep the lawns. Like stuff like that. But whereas Cooley High is kind of fascinating because Eric Monte says even at the time, like Cabrini Green was still pretty together. I think at the time, if a building burnt down, they would take it down. They wouldn't just leave it, which by 1980, whatever, that was pretty much the policy. But he says that he wanted to show that even this place where, you know, it was a hot zone in 1975 where people were mad about it. But he wanted to say that this was also the best times of my life. You know, it was, and I think that that's the fascinating thing. I you wouldn't even know really that it's Cabrini Green unless you looked it up.
Yeah, I kept going, this is Cabrini Green. And well, the thing is, you know, and Candyman kind of puts that stereotype in your heads. And there's also this white savior kind of aspect with, you know, the main character and like Helen. And it's, you know, it's like, just, yeah. So I think, yeah, Cooley High is something that people need to see to kind of see the real nature of, again, people living in areas that aren't maybe that great, but people live there. Yeah, so, you know.
And people have, people enjoy themselves. And and also, I think it's kind of, it's fascinating to see what it looked like. You're right. Like, I don't think I'd ever seen it as painted up and nice looking as it does in this film.
Well, I think we should leave it in Cabrini Green. So, Cameron Maitland, thank you so much for joining us once again. It was always such a pleasure. I know you love talking about Mike Schultz, so this is good.
Oh, well, I've got a Mike Schultz triple bill probably coming soon on Hollywood Street. Keep your eyes out.
That's so exciting. And Carolyn Morissette, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was great talking to you.
Oh, well, it was great having you on because, man, anytime I get to talk about Mahogany with someone who also loves it and also gets it, I'm like, thank you for getting this movie because I love it so much. All right. And you can join us again next week where we're going to look at a bunch of destructive rock and roll weirdos. That's The Who and Ken Russell coming up next week.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Alicia Fletcher and Cameron Maitland. Our guests today were Cameron Maitland and Carolyn Morissette. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.